Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. The book is Coffee with Hitler, the untold story of the amateur spies who tried to civilize the Nazis. Charles Spicer is the author, and these are revelations of scenes and conduct that I had no knowledge of all these decades of reading about the catastrophe of the Second War. We now go to September 1935 at Nuremberg, the annual rally of the Nazi Party, capped off by a speech by the dictator. We introduce Graham Christie, a man who is quite as romantic as Hollywood could imagine. Charles Spicer has done us the extreme favor of recovering Graham Christie in his modesty and his heroism his whole life. He was an aviator, a war hero, and a man who risked his life again and again to find a way to avoid the war that was ahead in 39. Charles, Graham Christie is so much, it's so overwhelming. What is important to know about him and his role in the Anglo-German Fellowship?
It's very important to understand his First World War track record. And he was an engineer. He'd been at school in Britain, which he'd hated, and went straight from that, from high school to Germany, where he studied as an engineer, where he excelled. So he's completely fluent in German and a Germanophile. He learns to fly. He's one of the first people, you know, one of the first aviators in the world, one of the first people to achieve powered flight. He commissions his own plane in 1913 and tours the north of England, demonstrating with another pilot, it's a two-seater, this biplane, to people who've never seen aircraft before. And when the war breaks out in the summer of 1914, by that point he owns two planes. He gives them to the British Army and signs up as a junior officer, even though he's in his 30s, so quite old when the average pilot's only 20. He joins up and he flies throughout the war. And he is, as well as being a brilliant engineer, he's a brilliant aviator. He was one of the very first people to do tactical bombing. And that's bombing from a plane in the middle of a battle over a key asset to try and disrupt the enemy. He's taking a, I worked out, he's flying an aircraft which weighs about the same of a horse as a horse. And he's taking a bomb up with no bomb launching capabilities. He's just dumping it over the side of the open plane, a bomb that weighs about the size of as the average woman. So these extraordinary physical feats. And he carries on flying all the way through the war and ends up very decorated with an MC, CMG, and a DSO as a wing commander. And he's exhausted. He's shattered. He appears to have had some form of nervous breakdown, they would have called it in those days, so mental health, PTSD, I would guess we would now diagnose it. And it takes him a year or two just to recover from the trauma of his war. And he then dedicates himself to trying to understand what's happening in Germany and feeding that information. So unlike Colonel Evans and Tennant, he's always an intelligence agent. They become that later on. He serves as the air attaché for a while in the British Embassy in Washington, and then he does the British Embassy in Berlin.
Yes, there are three of them now: Ernest Tennant, Philip Conwell Evans, and now we're talking Graham Christie. Graham Christie has a working relationship with another man who's critical to understand these in between war years, Van Sittart. Who is he?
Sir Robert Van Sittart. He is the head of the British Foreign Office, the civil service head, which is called the Permanent Undersecretary. And he does that service. He does that for about 10 years, having previously been private secretary to a couple of British prime ministers. So he's a career civil servant and diplomat. And he's a passionate anti-appeaser. He is consistently lobbying the British government to take the threat of the rise of Nazism more seriously.
And all of this comes to 1935. We'll stop at September of 35. This is the annual meeting of the Nazi Party at Nuremberg. And this is the time, again, where those seeking rapprochement have to deal with what is obviously unacceptable from the Nazi regime, which is the Nuremberg laws. And even their biggest apologists are struck by this. How do they explain it to themselves in the newspapers in London? The Nuremberg laws are the predicate for what we now understand to be the Holocaust.
Yes, I mean, the Nuremberg laws, which are, you know, as recent scholars have pointed out, that the Germans actually based on the Jim Crow laws. They're a systematic set of legislation designed to divide two populations by discriminating against one. And contrary to what had been believed before, what I discovered is that the book's protagonists on the British side, heroes, one might say, really were appalled by this, were deeply shocked by this, but chose to lobby their German friends, their Nazi friends, privately, but very vocally, and to try and persuade them that this is wrong on a number of levels. And in a cynical point of view, they think it's bad for business. They can't understand why it's a priority for this regime, which has so much else to do.
Yes, because Germany is rebuilding or attempting to rebuild. There's a worldwide financial crisis, never far from anyone's mind because of the repeated stories of poverty, the threat to capitalism, and also the dominating story of the Soviets and Joseph Stalin, never far from the rationalization of why we need to work with Germany. Because Germany is under threat as we are, goes the argument from the Soviet Union.
Yes.
So we don't leave that out of the driving motive. If we don't work together, the Soviets will take over everything. Now, at the Party Congress, at the Nuremberg meetings each year, and there'll be another one in 36, there is a complete, clear display of militarism. Does that worry the foreign ministry at this point? Because it's a puzzle how you can see it and not see it, Charles. That's a story that your book again raises and again.
You mean, does it British Foreign Office?
Yes, you can see the militarism, but you don't know what to do with it.
It's a really good question. I think it worries them, but they don't do much with it. I don't think they focus on it nearly as much as they should. You have the Anglo-German Naval Agreement, 34-35, when they allow Hitler to build up his navy, equivalent to a third of the British Navy. They clearly, with a benefit of hindsight, they should have been much more focused on it. Christie is consistently urging them. He's particularly focused on the build up of the Air Force, which is why he builds his relationship with Goering.
Yes, we need to mention that relationship. I'm glad. Yeah. There's so many, Charles. We get overwhelmed. It is an accident of history that Graham Christie is related to two or three very brave people living on the Dutch. Is it the Dutch-German border?
Yeah.
The Schusters. And he's related to them, but they're related to Hermann Göring. And Göring is an air hero. Christie's an air hero. And they have a friendship. I guess that's the only way we can describe this. A man who is presented by the American version of the war as one of the monsters also has friendships with one of the heroes of the English side of the war.
Absolutely. And in those days, he could appear to be one of the more civilized Nazis and quite internationalist. He had a Swedish wife to whom he was devoted. He was convinced Anglophile. He admired the British aristocracy with their hunting and their shooting and their stately homes, and actually, you know, replicated that for himself at his own home. So he has a genuine conviction, and he always wanted to try and negotiate peace with Britain or maintain peace with Britain.
We need to go now to Graham Christie's phone call. This is March of 36. Graham Christie calls, my note says Saturday, 7 March. Your reporting, it feels like you are there. A phone call from Graham Christie to Van Sittart, Sir Van Sittart, saying that there's trouble at the border. This is the Rhineland. Now, of the moments in your book where I wanted to reach in and say, don't you see? Can't you do something? Christie gives London a day's to move, a day warning that Hitler's going to make this move into the Rhineland, violating the terms of both the Versailles Treaty and the Locarno Treaty. So London knows, they're not completely unaware, and you report that Hitler thought it was going to fail. Why doesn't London react? Is that still a mystery, Charles?
Generally, the sentiment was very pacifist. They had the peace ballot recently, and the electorate was had no patience for military action at the time, had voted 90% in favor of demilitarization and in favor of not responding to these sorts of actions in an overly militaristic way. I think the point you make, John, is absolutely spot on. I think almost all historians who study this period would agree that this was the greatest missed opportunity. Hitler thought there was he only sent, 30,000 soldiers into the Rhineland, and the standing army in France is 1 million. If they had just marched in, they didn't need to fire a shot. Hitler had arranged for his soldiers not to have live ammunition because he didn't want it to turn into a shooting battle. And so it's a tragedy that it would have been the one time if we'd stood up to him, it could well have changed the path to towards war, removed that path.
I'm speaking to Charles Spicer. He is the historian who gives us Coffee with Hitler, the untold story of the amateur spies who tried to civilize the Nazis. 1936 is also the year of the Olympics. And when we come back, what is that opportunity for the Anglo-German Fellowship of London and the Deutsche Englische Gesellschaft of Berlin? I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience, has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.